there, and welcome to the Speak Up with Laura Camacho podcast. This is episode 227. We have an incredible guest for you today. He's an architect who was born in rural Florida, and he now has offices in Los Angeles and Charlotte. He is into retail and these new places where it's retail and shops, which is retail, and restaurants and businesses and places to live. I think they call it mixed use communities, but he's all about creating a sense of place. You're going to love it. But before I let you listen to what Cabin Kelly has to say, he has a book out called Irreplaceable, by the way. We have a new sponsor, and the new sponsor is a new product called the Speak Up 360. So I know you all know what 360s are, but now there's one that is created by yours truly that focuses on high-level communication skills. There's a whole section on influence. There's a section on presentation skills, section on how you show up in meetings. There's a section on executive presence. Very specific. You don't even need coaching. If you get this 360, you don't need coaching because you know exactly where you're good, where you need to work, and if you need to work in a certain area. And of course, you know, just say executive presence. There's a number of micro skills that build up into and roll up into executive presence. You're going to know exactly what you need to work on, and there's going to be tips there. So I think it's the best product ever. I may put myself out of business eventually, but that's okay. Speak Up 360 for information. Email hello@speakupwithlaura.com. And one more thing, we are really advancing with our campaign to get more podcast reviews. We're now up to 38 on iTunes and 10 on Spotify. And the goal is 100, but they're so good. Y'all are so nice, so kind. This is one from an improv fan in Charlotte. She says, keeps me guessing. Laura finds the most interesting guest and teases out their unique expertise in such a fun and engaging way. I love listening to these interviews for inspiration and new ideas for approaching my work and bringing my authentic self to the table. The tips she and her guests share are pure gold that you won't find anywhere else. These are one-of-a-kind conversations. So thank you so much, improv fan in Charlotte. I am very humbled by this extremely kind comment, and definitely that's what we're trying to do. We want conversations that you're not hearing on 7 other channels. In fact, if you're new to this podcast, you may be already a little confused. Speak Up with Laura Camacho is all about talking to super interesting people, leaders in their fields, and we get to communication in that process. We get to community building. We get to selling ideas. But in the process, you learn like what's going on in other domains besides your own. So it's super cool. There's this one podcast. It's all about people talking about what's going on with the royal families in Europe. I was like, there's a podcast about that? There's people that actually take time out of their day to listen to that? That is not what we cover on the Speak Up with Laura Camacho podcast. We talk to people who are leaders in their field, and we learn from the best. So without further ado, here is Kevin Kelly. So Kevin, I'm excited to have you here. Everybody listening, you're in for a special treat. Kevin Kelly is an architect working out of Los Angeles. He does have an office in Charlotte. So hello to everybody listening from Charlotte and Los Angeles. But he grew up in rural Florida. So I really loved the stories in his book called Irreplaceable, which is not about personal branding. It's really about place. First of all, he knows how to sell big ideas, but he is really about the future of place. So many of you listening to this are working with AI. I think everybody that works either directly or tangentially with AI is a little bit concerned about place. So our guest today, Kevin Kelly, has some definite thoughts about creating places where people want to hang out. But I want to start off with, first of all, super big welcome. And how did you decide to become an architect?
Great, Laura. Thank you for having me, first of all. You know, not everyone knows what they want to be when they're young kids. Sometimes it takes us 30, 40 years to figure out what we want to be. But I knew what I wanted to be at six. I wanted to be an architect, and I had never met an architect. I didn't know what they do. But I was fascinated with how spaces affect people's moods and their behavior, their desire to be nice to other people or mean to other people. And so I was constantly moving around furniture in our home, turning lights down and music up. I could notice I could make everybody get along better if I adjusted the environment. And then I kind of moved on to my friends' houses and the school. And eventually I knew I'd need a bigger playing field, and architecture was that place for me. And, you know, most architects are kind of fixated on aesthetics and what we call the laws of aesthetics, composition, scale, symmetry, asymmetry, the visual, which is important to me, but I'm less interested in style and much interested in how people behave, which is much more subconscious. We're not aware of how our environment affects us. We don't get up in the morning with a walking plan, and we don't decide to move to the right or left because something made us a little nervous. Ahead of us, these are decisions that our lizard brain makes. And I spend a lot of time trying to understand that, how that affects our behavior, but also our perceptions. When I say perceptions, I don't mean just our, you know, emotional perceptions, but really our deep-seated primal perceptions. And then also, ultimately, our decisions. You know, how do we one thing over the other? And that may be a package. It may be an aisle in a grocery store. It may be an entire community where we decide to live, or which university we go to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And guys listening, Kevin does a lot, maybe all of his work is in retail, in shops, and in shopping centers. Maybe not all of it. But I was thinking, of course, you know, coming from a totally different background, I was reading about, and I was thinking about workplaces. And then, you know, it's, we're in 2024, people are largely back to the office at least 3 days a week. This is kind of a double question, you know, your experience with workspaces, but also like the Google campus, Apple campus, a lot of people listening to this work there. So I would love your thoughts on that.
First of all, we work in a variety of industries. We do have a heavy focus in retail, but we also do a lot of large-scale mixed-use planning. My business partner heads up that practice. I work with a lot of urban districts, often nonprofits. I work with universities. I work with cities, large global cities even, and I work with things such as the Cleveland Orchestra, our museums. And so it's a fascinating background. And so, yes, and workplace, yes, we work with a lot of office buildings as well. And a lot of things during the pandemic kind of went away for a bit, such as the grocery store, the pub, or the nail salon, but then they started coming back. They kind of snapped back into place with a little difference. The one thing that has not snapped back in place at all is the office, and it has radically changed. We could look at it on a macro level and a more micro level. On the macro level, really, it's about the value proposition. We know that if you say, I'm going to go to that shopping center, it's an outdoor shopping center, or I'm going to go to that bar. We know, yes, I've got a park, I've got a drive, but here's the payoff. I have a great drink around a bunch of friends, or I get to meander around and feel like I'm part of a community. That proposition of dressing up, driving into downtown, dealing with commute traffic, to work in a place, and oftentimes a cubicle farm, it doesn't have what we call that dynamic is the work payoff ratio. It's a whole lot of work or effort to get that for little payoff. And the payoff of urban districts, really office districts and central business districts, used to be proximity, to be anybody and anywhere. You needed to be close to the movers and shakers and the factories and the industries. But the laptop has changed all that, and we can run our businesses in a park, in a coffee shop, or Tahiti. The movers and shakers have left Wall Street and now live in Miami or Austin. And so on a macro level, we've got to change that value equation or that value proposition for what an office park or central business district offers. It has to offer something more unique than just proximity to other workers. You'll see cities that I'm working with, some of them that are becoming 24-hour playgrounds. They're becoming great places for young professionals and creatives to be around each other. Now, as we go inside the office, yes, we're seeing that change as well. Everybody's tried to get people back to work, and they've mandated policies, they've changed salaries, and none of it is working. It's just
great.
Not
everybody
hitting.
Hates it.
Yeah, it's just not hitting at the level they want. And really what we've been doing in our own offices and for our clients is really making it less about policy or mandate and much more like a clubhouse, a fort for other like-minded souls with passion to hang out, socialize, bond, collaborate, have fun. And so we're changing that mentality a lot, which is making the workplace not seem like work, but really a kind of leisure, recreational, inspirational activity.
But would this be a place, or will this be a place where you would work? I do your meetings there, but you would, if you're an engineer or a data analyst where you have to just like crunch numbers a lot of the day, you would do that at home and then go to this other place, the clubhouse, the work clubhouse for work. Is that the idea?
That is the idea. And think about how much, particularly in our modern era, our personal identity is attached to our work identity. And it's very important for us to be not only proud of what we do, but connected to what we do, and to be recognized by our peers for what we do and to celebrate what we do. And so we use a lot of those components to think about the office as a place to reaffirm identities, to celebrate identities, and to be about a cause. I mean, any group of humans, and it doesn't matter in the world of, say, Harley Davidson, which I work in, or the world of ceramics or the world of martial arts, everybody's trying to figure out how to move up and through the system. And the way we learn the system is by watching each other, observing each other. It's very hard to do that online. You can do some of it, but 90% of how we learn is body language. And so there's something really powerful that happens inside a workspace. And so our workspace, we already do it now, is really about having a lot of gatherings to brainstorm, to have fun around our work and think about our work in different ways. But we don't require anybody to come in. They can come in when they want. And many of them say, oh, thank gosh, I'm here.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I get a break.
Right. You know? Especially if there's young children at home, it can be a bit chaotic, or other reasons can bring chaos.
Well, there's something about, we take for granted. Well, I'll put it this way. Arnold Schwarzenegger said something a long time ago when he had a bunch of money. They said, why don't you have an incredible gym at home? Why do you drive in to here, the gym? And he said, you know, there's something about getting dressed and putting my bag together, getting in the car and shifting my mind. So when I get to the gym, which was his work, there's all these hungry, aggressive people that want to beat him. And he's like, it makes me better at what I do. I feel the same about work. I feel like at times there's something about getting dressed, driving or walking to work and changing your mind and being around other people that is very empowering. I mean, even just a simple act of changing your clothes, going out to lunch.
Absolutely. You know? And doing the reverse when you get home, that I mean, the first thing you do is change out of your work clothes because you're not working. At least it was a more stronger delineation.
And the separation of space is really nice, right? I worked from home, obviously, during the pandemic, like a lot of people. And I knew while I was sleeping where my papers were, what I needed to do. And sometimes I'd wander down there and do a couple of things. And my wife would be like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I just figured I'd knock it out.
Yeah, it's hard.
Not
it's
good.
It is not good. It's not good. It's not good for your family, but it's also not good for your brain and for your best ideas to have that cut off.
Yeah, and I worry the most about young people having to learn from the bosses. I mean, we did great during the pandemic and not working in an office. And when I say we did great, our seasoned employees did good. But I think younger employees benefit from watching bosses interact, get chewed out by somebody or chew somebody out or yell or scream or do different things. There's something that happens when you watch other people, right? We just learn so much from seeing that behavior. And that doesn't happen, but totally online all the time. This is not a binary debate, either in the office or not the office. I think we're going to see it evolve, but I worry more about kind of the old paradigm structures we have of giant skyscrapers, you know, office buildings, and what is going to happen to that model.
So one of the themes of his books, people, is about the place. And he, yes, he does. He mentioned this WPA. I wrote it down somewhere. I don't see it now.
The work, work payoff ratio.
Work WPR. Payoff.
Yeah.
Yeah. You use that when your firm decides whether to accept projects also?
Yeah. We primarily use it to evaluate any place. So if it's an opera house, we look at, well, how much work does it take me to go there and what's the payoff? And we try to evaluate that for somebody that's done it forever or a young teen who's never been to an opera. We try to evaluate it with department stores or a shopping center or a restaurant. You know, we try to figure out, well, how much work does it take to go get this? Because we're kind of living in a replacement economy. And anybody that is of age walks around and sometimes shakes their head a little bit about how much the world has changed, right? Particularly when we start explaining to younger kids, like, well, we didn't have that. Well, it's a little hard for us sometimes. And what everything is being replaced, right? Travel agencies, maitre d's, coins. I had coins in my pocket the other day. My daughter, 5-year-old daughter, hadn't seen them. And I had to try to explain to her what quarters and meters were because she doesn't see a lot of that.
You know? Wow.
And so if any place is going to survive, it can't compete on, at least physical places, can't try to win on price, variety, convenience, or efficiency per se only. It really has to win on a social payoff. And things like discovery, delight, adventure, bonding. And I can show you hundreds, thousands of places that are doing unbelievably well by not competing on price, convenience, or ruthless efficiency.
I was thinking of the grocery stores. Like, going to the grocery store is a necessary evil. And I don't do the pickup because I want to pick out my own produce. But yeah, it's like get in and get out. And I do like Trader Joe's, which he mentions as being, you know, it is more fun products. It's kitschy, but I never thought about grocery stores. It's basically still the factory model from 100 years ago. So tell our audience, like, what's going on with grocery stores? Is that going to change too?
The reason to go to a grocery store previously, prior to the internet, was it was the only place in town to get what you needed. So you had to go there, and grocery stores did not have to worry about your convenience or even your comfort primarily. They built a store that works for them at their convenience and what we call logistics and load in and pack out. All the aisles and everything were constructed for their convenience because they get in really early in the morning and they take care of things. And it's a incredibly elaborate supply model is what we call, but they never had to worry about creating demand, at least not as much, because normally when a grocery store went in a community, they were going to get enough of you. But in this new era, they don't even have the demand because there's a whole lot of options. You can go online, you can have your groceries delivered, you could sit on your couch and never get out of your PJs.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden they're trying to figure out how to create demand, but they don't have a lot of demand side thinkers. They have a unbelievable amount of logistics side thinkers. Now, AI and automation has been replacing a lot of that kind of demand side, supply side thinking and making it a lot easier. And so the grocery stores we work with, which again, I have hundreds of examples, we don't sell that idea of you can just come here and get the same thing you can get online. We sell the idea of being able to bond with neighbors and hang out, have a beer, kind of the Cheers model, and celebrate your community and be there. And think about all the grocery stores that are in your neighborhoods on the corner. And you can't imagine the number of people that feel like, I just want to get out and do something. And so we're building full-scale bars and restaurants in our grocery stores. And we have some grocery stores. We just finished one. That's what I was going to say earlier. We just finished a Mexican grocery store called Northgate Mercado. It's Northgate Market, but the actual name of this store is called Mercado. It's off the charts. We have to turn people away because so many people are coming to the store. It's actually our biggest problem because it's so packed. It'll be the first grocery store I've ever worked on that'll probably do $100 million a year because it's just people coming to hang out and socialize around this culture. And this is both Mexican consumers and kind of non-Mexican consumers coming there. We actually have more what we call food tourists coming in, and we have a tamaleria, churro. Again, another problem we're having is people are hanging out in the store so long to see the bands that we have to figure out, okay, we got to get them to, we got to get them to go. That's changing the meaning of a grocery store. And that's what I think you'll see all the way around as you drive down the road and see all kinds of physical places that are being replaced in this replacement economy. I think you have to think, what is it that would get people to crawl through mud to go there? What are they willing to do? And a good place to always start with anybody, this isn't how it works all the way across, but just think about single people. You know, what do they want? They want to bump elbows and be in contact with other people, but then take it up to young married couples, people with kids, empty nesters. We all need to get out and have a social identity, you know, and be around other people.
Right.
And so we're doing that. I gave you one example, but I could give you, that's my forte.
Yeah. One thing I noticed is it seems like that this movement about place and architecture is about realizing that the audience or consumer or whatever are all in a different place and architecture needs to adapt to that. Is that, am I right?
Yeah. So much in our world has advanced and progressed and kind of evolved and even changed. I don't really believe architecture has changed enough. We're in a place every day. You're in a place right now. I'm in a place, and we're never unplaced. That's the interesting thing. So every memory, every thought, every situation in our life happens in some place. And we like to say we're in a place, but we never think about that place is in us. And it affects us, just like fast food or junk food affects us. If you eat too much of that stuff, unhealthy food, you won't live long. Your quality of life will suffer. Well, it's the same with place. People that live in bad places or work in bad places don't have great lives. They don't have social networks, and they don't know their neighbors, and they're fearful and fretful, and bad things happen in neighborhoods that are harsh. And so we have to fix our environments to make them better. But the problem is we've had in our life two kinds of places in the last, I'd say, 50 years. We have very utilitarian places, which tend to be harsh. So they look kind of like warehouses or buildings that have no scale and don't relate to the human body. Or we have these public spectacle, intellectual, abstract projects that intentionally nobody understands except the highbrows. And those two extremes are not right. What we need is buildings that really make the average person's lives better and really help them live better lives. I'm in a fight with my own profession to say, let's stop analyzing and doing talkitecture. Let's just stop with this art thesis where we're going to inflict our theory on the public, you know, our art project on the public. If they like Velveeta cheese, then I don't need to teach them to like, let's meet people where they're at. Now, why retail, which may be a good question, because for thousands of years, we've gone to the, what you'd call the market, the bazaar, the ancient agora. We've always met at these kind of trading posts. And not only are we exchanging dollars for wheat, we're exchanging ideas and cultures and meaning and rituals. I mean, people generally met their significant other at the public market and raised their kids. And those kids, again, watched others and learned how to behave in public. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering what happened, you know, to our society. Why do people fight so much on planes? And why are people so rude to each other these days? And we could talk about a variety of different things, but I think unless we learn how to behave physically in public, we don't understand those behaviors. We track how much time young kids spend online and how many days we give up a year. 105 days a year we give up online.
Wow. That's almost a third.
And that's research-based. And if you look back at the 105 days we use, some of that's productive and a lot of it's doom scrolling. You know?
Right. Because I've got 10 minutes before my next call, I'm going to, you know, veg out.
Well, as opposed to reflecting or being present to your environment or the ones with. And so, again, not a binary argument, just trying to leave room and space in our lives for understanding how we're physically infected. And, you know, our bodies are designed to react to physical environment. Everything about our head shape, our eyes, our senses, everything about that is wired to understand physical place. And we're kind of messing with these things as well.
I love that. I think we're both fans of somebody. I don't know if you know this book. It's called...
So that store is right near where I live, the Paul Smith store.
Yes! And, I bought this used two weeks ago. And then I read your book, and you're mentioning Paul Smith. So everybody...
I'm a block away from this place.
So Kevin is a block away. I had never heard of Paul Smith until somebody from, David Hyatt, who I met through my friends at Eat Big Fish, just mentioned him in a very positive way. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to look him up. And it's also women's now, but it's mostly men's clothing. He's British. Paul Smith is British. He's got to be in his 70s. He was really big in Japan. He was going to be a professional bicycler, and he had a bicycle wreck, and he ended up becoming a men's. He's kind of a designer, but he didn't study design. He started with a shop that was like 3 yards by 3 yards. And anyway, Kevin mentions Paul Smith in his book. I've never been in a Paul Smith store. Tell me about his store and how that creates a sense of place.
Yeah, I think all of us want to stand out. Let's back up and say that. We all want to stand out and be recognized. And most of us don't have the money to be on Main and Main, and our state in Maine. And so, we have to figure out what can we do. We have to be resourceful, which is a really important quality I think I look for in designers, is not necessarily can they design with giant budgets. It's can they design with no budget and no tools and no great properties per se. So when Paul Smith came to LA, he couldn't go on Rodeo Drive. I mean, maybe he could have, but he just didn't want to financially do that. He took a nondescript building on Melrose and this part of Melrose, nobody really was stopping at. It wasn't a shopping district in this particular one. The building had no windows, had one little tiny door. And sure, he could have spent $5 million and renovated, but instead he went and bought the wildest color pink you've ever seen, which has now become a super famous pink, and painted the entire building this pink wall. It stops you. It arrests your attention. And now 60 to 90,000 people come by this store every year to photograph themselves all day long. As I said, I live here. So all day long, I'm dealing with tourists that come here and get a picture of themselves standing in front of this pink wall. And it is now such a phenomenon that has created the whole district as a retail district. And what it's done for him is everybody knows it's a landmark. So whenever I'm talking to anybody, they're like, well, is it east or west of the Paul Smith store? It's that resourcefulness of how to stand out and the anti-logic of that. And I mean, I'm attacking my own profession, which, wants you to build giant columns and steps and some architectural gymnastic feature, but it's just a couple of cans of paint. When you watch a film, you don't want to be aware of the set design. You want the set design to be so believable that it reinforces the story. And that's what places need to have. And the story is not about the architect. The story is about the user and their ego.
But you're not blaming capitalism? Because I think about thing.
No, it's all a dynamic. Capitalists understandably want to get a high return on investment, reduce costs. They want to reduce difficulty. Designers, oftentimes, not all the time, but they want to do art. They want to do something beautiful and something they're proud of. Where I think things break down, and you're a much bigger expert than I am on this, but it's language. And we have a real problem in our field with language. And we use terms in our two cottage industries. Capitalism is really not cottage industries, but big industries in design and capitalism that don't really work. And so in the book, I outline a lot of tools about, hey, let's get rid of that language and let's develop a new language because we're in a fight together. Anybody that's really trying to build place and save place, if we don't do some great things to save place, they won't be around. We've already lost a tremendous amount of places.
Yes, we have, and we will continue to, because the incentive structure is completely different because of technology, which people are working on. Well, you have different ideas. You have been successfully selling them. How do you do that?
Sometimes I joke because people say, what do you do for a living? And I say, I convince skeptical audiences of the power of human emotions. And what I mean by that is I spend at least once a week inside a boardroom of skeptical leaders who are generally more financially driven or spreadsheet focused, who are terrified of seeing a designer come in with some wild idea that's going to break the bank. And so how do I crack that audience? I always start with human truths first, and generally funny human truths. My formula to go in and sell an idea is you got to break the ice. And I normally show something that they can relate to. And sometimes that'll be using my mother and father because they're two completely different people, Cecil and Nina. One is Martha Stewart and the other is Archie Bunker. And audiences love that. Their names are Cecil and Nina. And they'll come up to me after and go, my gosh, our company's like Cecil or our company's like Nina. And so I break the ice and get that going. If I get them laughing, I've won. Everything is going to go from there. But I generally use a human insight as my first step. My second step is to outline some principles of what's going on. Why do men behave so badly in public? If that's my theory and my human insight, then I break down the principles of why. Then I show some examples, and then I show them what they should do. I'll get to them, and I'm like, and so here's what you do. The only way people can do those kind of things is to be bold and have massive courage, which is very, very difficult. And I'm like a stockbroker in that people are entrusting me with $20, $50, $100 million worth of their money. And we have to really make wise decisions on how to do that. And so I got to build their courage. And in that room, the only way to build courage is through insights and anomalies, is to show them insights of other things they like, and then the tiny little things that they're not noticing, and then go, this is where we're going to focus on. Again, we're trying to take complex ideas and tangibilize them into generally visual metaphors. And you might say, well, give me an example. When we were working for Whole Foods, you know, they had a complex theory of what they wanted the market to buy. And I'm going back a long time ago in the earlier days. And we found if we showed farmers in the field with big sickles plowing a kind of agrarianism, what we call a field of meaning, it helped the consumer understand, oh, you're having an agrarian Mother Earth approach that's fighting Monsanto, a chemical lab approach.
Right.
So anytime I can tangibilize and manifest a complex idea into something that people can relate to physically or from a sensory standpoint, then that helps them.
Why did you write Irreplaceable? Mention, at least go over a little bit, the bonfire effect. And of course, we're going to link it in the show notes. It's a super interesting book that I think has insight for all of y'all to take away the how important place is. And I think when you, like, our minds are like libraries, and you add a book about architecture, is going to inform the other books in your mind. But you
That's
tell
great.
Us.
What a wonderful analogy. Yes, I am a concerned human that looks around at the world and wants the world to be healthy and thrive. I have a daughter, I told you, that's young. And when I look around at what's happening in the world, I try to think, you know, we're losing so much and we're gaining at the same time. But what are the things we don't want to lose? And I do want us to be able to meet our friends and neighbors and strangers, I guess. I want to be able to meet people. And that, as I said, has happened at the market. Prior to the pandemic happening, there was already a reduction in the amount of time people were spending outside of their homes. We could see that. And the effects it was having on our ability to socially cooperate and navigate our world, particularly differences with other people. And most of that training happens in physical places. So I was trying to help figure that out. When the pandemic hit, then I realized place was in trouble. Like, we really got to try to save place and save those operators, particularly the layer of local shops. That is what concerned me the most, is that we're flirting with a dangerous world of having three big companies handle all our food and about six people handle all our retail goods. And their cost of doing business is so incredibly lower than the cost of doing business for a local merchant that it's almost impossible for a local medium-sized merchant to stay in the game. And we're about to lose that entirely. We're dangerously flirting with that. So that's one idea. The second thing you asked about, you know, about the bonfire. When I was a kid, I grew up in the swamplands, and during the week, we'd spend all the time building these elaborate buggies and motorcycles and vehicles to go 2 miles out into the horizonless swamp to hit this kind of redneck Riviera where we'd all hang out. And at the end of the day of spending time in the mud, a self-organizing group of people would build this bonfire, this giant bonfire, and they would, without any kind of leader, at least a formal thing, they would elect a bonfire master. And that person's job was to make that fire perfect. It couldn't be too hot or too wild, and it couldn't be too small. That person had to attract everybody and create like a vibe that everybody gathered around. And when everybody gathered around that bonfire, we all got along and kind of this amazing kind of chemistry. And we drank beer and we sang redneck anthems and we bonded. And I thought, what is that quality? And it took me much later in life to learn that Carl Jung talked about this. It's called participation mystique, this idea of just being around each other. And then I really dedicate, this was in college, I was learning about this. I said, I'm going to dedicate my life to seeing if I could create bonfire effects and really look at who in the company manages the bonfire, which we oftentimes call chief brand officer. But a bonfire really has to have a magic glow, a mystic quality, and it has to unite people into a community.
That's awesome. I thank you so much. This has been very enlightening, very entertaining, interesting. And I feel like we, all of us, all of the super smart, extremely attractive people listening, you all have ideas and insider information about where architecture is going and where it needs to go. Thank you so much.
Love your show.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank you for listening to this wonderful episode with Kevin Kelly about how important it is to have a place, how to think about creating bonfire effect in the place that you work, or it could be your home maybe. I would really appreciate it if you would leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast, and we will catch you on the next episode. Have a fantastically splendid day. Goodbye.